This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. A lawyer for the whistleblower who made public President Trump's dealings with Ukraine says his client is willing to answer written questions from House Republicans. We get more from AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
In a tweet, attorney Mark Zaid writes, Congressman Devin Nunes, the top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, has been approached about the whistleblower answering questions from Republicans in writing. President Trump has demanded the person's identity made public since his call to the president of the Ukraine became public. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel tells ABC's This Week a key reason for the impeachment inquiry.
Did the president really sell out his country?
But House Republican Whip Steve Scalise, also on ABC's This Week, says the Democrats are playing politics.
They don't want fair rules. They just want to hurt President Trump's chances to win re-election.
Tim McGuire, Washington.
The White House on Sunday defended President Trump's bid to get Ukraine to investigate one of his chief 2020 Democratic political rivals, former Vice President Joe Biden, saying the request didn't amount to an impeachable offense. One of Mr. Trump's top aides, Kellyanne Conway, told CNN nothing would lead to a high crime or misdemeanor. She was referring to the standard for impeaching a U.S. president after the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives approved proceedings for the impeachment inquiry. The Washington Post reported Sunday that smuggling gangs in Mexico are cutting through the wall President Trump has required to be built along the U.S.-Mexico border to keep migrants and drugs out of the country. The Post quoted border agents as saying that gangs have repeatedly made holes in the wall using a reciprocating saw, a tool that sells for as little as $100. The Post said that the holes created are wide enough for migrants and smugglers to enter. The president told reporters he's not concerned about the reports because the wall is designed to be fixed easily. This is VOA News. Anti-government protesters in Baghdad shut down roads and government offices in the Iraqi capital Sunday, escalating a month-long string of rallies demanding political change. Tens of thousands of demonstrators gathered in recent days in Baghdad's Tahrir Square and across southern Iraq, shutting down markets, factories, schools, and universities in protest of the political system in place since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion that toppled dictator Saddam Hussein. The prime minister called for the shuttered places to reopen, contending that the threat to oil facilities and closure of roads had cost Iraq millions of dollars and contributed to consumer price increases in the country. A pro-democracy politician and four other people were injured when a knife-wielding man attacked protesters in Hong Kong Sunday. More from Reuters' Amir McCarthy.
What started as a human chain in City Plaza Shopping Center in the eastern suburb of Taikoo Shing turned into a face-to-face conflict with police, with several people wounded. With blood dripping from his ear, Democratic District Councillor Andrew Chu was among the injured. Democratic Party lawmaker James To told reporters the attacker had bitten off part of Chu's ear and slashed other people. He said the other wounded were in more serious condition than Chu. Police said protesters had vandalised a restaurant in the mall after chanting peacefully. Several arrests were made and police say they are investigating the knife attack.
Reuters' Amir McCarthy. Protesters in Lebanon rallied Sunday to call for President Michel Aoun's ouster as part of a push for sweeping changes that already brought the resignation of the country's prime minister. VOA's Lattice Ahok.
President Aoun is a Maronite Christian, but some protesters say a government based on sectarian lines is bringing the country down.
We achieved part of our demands, which is the ousting of the government, and now we demand a neutral technocrat government and not a political one.
Joining protesters who demand economic and political reforms on Sunday was a large gathering of women calling for social changes.
Today, as women, we also have a role in coming out and carrying the demands like the rest of the protesters. We want this regime to go down because it is a paternal and sectarian system, which has oppressed women's issues and has put us at the mercy of the religious authorities for years.
President Aoun addressed the nation on Sunday, promising to focus on corruption, the economy, and the civil state, but acknowledging there is no easy road ahead. Zlatica Ahok, VOA News, Washington.
Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Today's Monday, November 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's recent demonstrations against sanctions orchestrated by the Southern African Development Community appears to have had the opposite effect.
I think that the sanctions against Zimbabwe are targeted sanctions. Those sanctions are against individuals, their family members, and particular entities that have been most responsible for undermining Zimbabwe's democracy and human rights and social fabric.
Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, Johnny Carson, justifying the sanctions. The student leadership of Makerere University in Uganda will meet striking students today, Monday, to brief them on the progress about their demands for raising fees to be scrapped. Six French and Ugandan campaign groups sue energy giant Total to disclose how it is addressing the human and environmental impact of a Ugandan oil field. And a Nigerian business raises millions of dollars in capital to expand its ride-hailing services.
Where political will doesn't exist, then the onus falls on Ugandan citizens and the world citizens to demand that these mitigation plans are put in place and that Total does the right thing.
Diana Nabiruma, a senior program and communications officer at the African Institute for Energy Governance, AFIEGO. Those stories, plus Samson Yomale's sports report, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe's recent demonstrations against sanctions orchestrated by the Southern African Development Community appears to have had the opposite effect on the United States, which added a minister in the president's office to the list of those already on targeted sanctions. As Ndiamake Mwakalere of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports, the removal or maintaining of sanctions remains largely a game of politics.
As Zimbabwe was wrapping up its day of national activities to protest against sanctions, as called for by the Southern African Development Community, SADC, the United States, which has the highest number of the country's government, ruling ZANU-PF party officials, and several businesses on its targeted list, announced the addition of Owen Ngube, Minister of State for National Security, in President Emmerson Mnangagwa's office to the list of more than 140. In a statement posted on his Twitter account Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said he designated Ngube for his involvement in gross violation of human rights in Zimbabwe. A proponent of sanctions on Zimbabwe is former U.S. Secretary of State for Africa and also Zimbabwe, Johnny Carson, who says the sanctions must stay because Mnangagwa's government has not reformed.
I think that the sanctions against Zimbabwe are targeted sanctions. Those sanctions are against individuals, their family members, and particular entities that have been most responsible for undermining Zimbabwe's democracy and human rights and social fabric. I think those sanctions should in fact remain in place until we see some more and serious fundamental changes in Zimbabwe.
Mnangagwa and his government contend that they are making the changes recommended by the U.S. in the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Amendment Act of 2018, ZIDERA, such as appealing the controversial media law IPA, or Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, and also opening up political space by engaging opposition politicians and argue the sanctions should be removed as a result. Speaking from the National Sports Stadium in Harare Friday, where the anti-sanctions protesters gathered, President Mnangagwa accused the U.S. of setting unrealistic standards for his country.
No amount of propaganda can spin or sugarcoat this gruesome truth. The continued judgment and setting of utopian standards for Zimbabwe, which are never applied in any other jurisdictions, are callous, vindictive, and should not be allowed to continue. This is the basis on which we say enough is enough. Remove these sanctions.
Ambassador Carson acknowledged efforts by Mnangagwa's government to reform, but said they're not enough. Responding to SADC's decision to show solidarity with Zimbabwe against the sanctions, Ambassador Carson said while it is important for the U.S. to listen to the region's views, he urged SADC to hold Zimbabwe accountable for the state of the economy and the allegations of human rights against its citizens. Zimbabwe's opposition groups, including the Movement for Democratic Change, have argued that Zimbabwe's government has imposed sanctions on itself and should reform for the country to recover. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, I'm Dimyake Mwakalielie in Washington.
Six French and Ugandan campaign groups have asked a French court to order energy giant Total to disclose how it's addressing the human and environmental impact of a Ugandan oil field. Total insists that it was working in Uganda in compliance with national and international standards. In their legal application, the six campaign groups said that Total had not met that obligation. One of the groups is Africa Institute for Energy Governance, AFIEGO, a public policy research and advocacy NGO dedicated to influencing energy policies to benefit the poor and vulnerable. Diana Nabiruma is a senior program and communications officer. She dropped by our studios in Washington, and I began by asking her what's the lawsuit all about.
Total is operating a project in Uganda called the Tilenga Project. This project is found in Murchison Falls National Park. Part of the project is in the park. And Total is also going to construct a pipeline under River Nile, which is shared with over 10 countries. And Total, with its joint venture partners, are going to abstract water from Lake Albert, which we share with the Democratic Republic of Congo. That is double the amount that Uganda's National Water and Sewerage Corporation gives to Ugandans per day. So the Total's actions are going to have a great impact in terms of reducing communities' access to water, communities' access to fisheries, our relations with the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Nile riparian states. While this is the case, and of course the actions are going to have an impact on biodiversity because they are in a national park. While this is the case, when Total submitted its environmental and social impact assessment report, this report was submitted and the study was undertaken to ensure that mitigations are put in place to avoid negative environmental and social impacts. When Total submitted this report, the report did not have mitigation plans at all. Mm-hmm. And as such, Ugandans are unaware how Total will be able to mitigate negative impacts on the environment, on water access, on biodiversity, on food security, without the mitigation plans being in place.
Did you ask the Ugandan government to address these concerns with Total?
Yes, we certainly did. In November 2018, two public hearings were held in the two districts in Uganda where Total's activities are based. And one of the things that CSOs, communities, MPs, local government leaders and others emphasized was that no mitigation plans were in place. The plans were not part of the SCA. And we told NEMA, which is the Uganda's National Environment Management Agency, that we needed mitigation plans to be in place before the Tilenga project could be approved by Uganda's Environment Management Agency.
Even if you succeed in the French court, still it would be the Ugandan government to ensure that Total complies. Is there political will on the part of the Ugandan government to do that?
Where political will doesn't exist, then the onus falls on Ugandan citizens and the world citizens to demand that these mitigation plans are put in place and that Total does the right thing.
Finally, why file in a French court and not a Ugandan one?
We do have two lawsuits in the Ugandan courts, but we also decided that it would be important to go to the French courts because the courts in France are more likely to be independent than the courts in Uganda.
That's Diana Nabiruma, a senior program and communications officer. She spoke with me from our Washington studios. Meanwhile, the student leadership of Makerere University in Uganda will meet striking students today, Monday, to brief them regarding the latest development about their demands for raising fees to be scrapped, according to Judith Nalukwago, the Students Guild vice president. She told my colleague Peter Clote that the students are determined to continue with the demonstrations until all their demands are met. Judith Nalukwago also calls for an independent inquiry into the brutalization of students by security operatives. This after calling for the suspension of two of the university officials she blames for giving the orders for the security officers to brutalize the demonstrating students.
Tomorrow, as student leaders, we sat down and we thought that it's important that we meet with the people we represent, because this leadership is supposed to be a consultative leadership. So in this demonstration, we've achieved something that is like 5% of what we wanted. So we want to explain to the students what exactly we've achieved, because some of them, we sent them in social media, but some of them have not understood. We want to give them the exact picture of what we have achieved, and we also listen to their feedback on how we should go ahead.
Professor Barnabas Nawangwe, the Vice Chancellor, issued a statement asking students to return to class, saying the situation was calm despite some hiccups. Why are you not adhering to his call for students to return to the classroom by you insisting that you will continue with the strike until your demands are fully met?
Students attending classes is not bad, but what is the point of students attending classes when in the long run they're not going to be exams? That is what we want to solve, because the tuition is so high that students yes attend in class, but you cannot get an examination permit when you have not finished your exam, when you have not finished your tuition. So that is why we want the university to commit until that yes, the tuition is going to be halted, so the students can do everything it takes to be able to find the little that is left so they can pay and be able to do exams. And this meeting we are calling for is to consult the students and see our way forward. It's not that we are saying that we as leaders, we are saying we should not stop the strike, but we want to consult the students. Should we continue the demonstration? Because actually, at this point in time, our major goal of halting the tuition, of this tuition policy, has not been achieved. And that is the reason why we came for this demonstration.
Why are you calling for investigation into what you describe as the brutalization of students? Because I understand the police and the security operatives are just there to enforce the law to ensure that no laws are broken by the students who are on strike.
One is students are allowed to protest. Even our constitution gives them the right to demonstrate if they are not satisfied with whatever is going on. But the military and police came in and made it violent by beating students, by destroying all their properties, where they intimidate them and they stop demonstrating. Though, recently they arrested the military commander who was in charge of that, brutalizing the students. Though as students, we are not happy because there are two administration members who ordered for that military to come and beat up the students. In fact, they gave us verbal threats. They gave us threats via text messages, and they told us they will switch off the cameras within the university, they will switch off the lights within the university, and they will beat the students, they will betray their property. But next day, it exactly happened the way they had narrated it. So we are asking the government, why aren't those people in administration being called to be investigated? Why are they investigating only the military people?
Judith Nalukwago is the vice president of the Makerere University Student Guild. She spoke with Peter Clote from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Today is Monday, November 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga in Washington. A Nigerian business has raised $7 million in capital to expand its ride-hailing services, which offer electric motorbikes and Okada taxis to customers in Lagos who use their application to order a ride. The company, Max.ng, is expanding its Lagos operations this year, and CEO Adetayo Bamiduro tells Ricky Shyrock the electric-powered vehicles reduce pollution, are easier to maintain, and are cost-effective. He says after the Nigerian expansion, they plan to offer the service in Ivory Coast and Ghana next year.
So what Max does is significantly more than just ride-hailing. So we're a vertically integrated mobility infrastructure company. Now, what I mean by that is that, you know, every single thing that is required to ensure that people are able to move around on a motorcycle or on a tuk-tuk safely in a reliable, predictable, and consistent way, Max fills in all that gap. So that includes things like providing financing for vehicles for qualified drivers, recruiting and training qualified drivers. Our work includes providing access to a ride-hailing app or a digital or mobile-enabled marketplace that allows users and small businesses to be able to hail Max drivers on demand.
How many bikes do you have on the road? How many drivers do you have on the road right now? And how many are you trying to get out there?
Right now, as we speak, because we're going very fast month on month. But at this very moment, we have close to about 1,500 drivers across three cities. We're scaling to about 5,000 drivers by the end of 2019. And we're targeting about 30,000 drivers in 2020.
And what are the main challenges?
Yes, one of the biggest challenges with scaling and building out our platform in a city like Lagos and in many other cities in West Africa is exactly the point you've made, that the existing legacy industry, transportation industry, is mostly informal. So if you look at Nigeria, for example, there are well over 10 million informal motorcycle taxi drivers and tuk-tuk drivers. And today, Max is only at 1,500, which is essentially still a drop in the ocean, right? So the biggest challenge we face is, with formalization for us, at least, as a platform comes, things like ensuring that drivers are properly trained and certified, before they get on board our platform, because it's absolutely critical for us to ensure safety and reliability on our platform and ensure that once every customer gets on the Max, on a Max powered motorcycle, taxi, or tuk-tuk, their safety is assured.
That was Adetayo Bamiduro, CEO of Max.ng. He was speaking to Ricky Shyrock from Lagos. New Zealand is hoping that by 2040, 1 million Kiwis will be able to speak a basic Maori language. The ambitious goal is part of an official strategy that sees the revival of New Zealand's indigenous language as a key part in national identity and reconciliation. For VOA, Phil Mercer reports from Gisborne, New Zealand.
Alien Weaponry is a Maori heavy metal band. Its album 2 went straight to number 1 in New Zealand. Its success is an unmistakable sign of the resilience of the Maori language. But census data has shown that the number of indigenous speakers in New Zealand has fallen. Glenys Philip Barbara, the former head of the Maori Language Commission, is though optimistic about the future.
There aren't as many people speaking Māori as I'd like. I mean, around 2 in 5 Māori can have a conversation in te reo Māori, which is still quite low. But look, we've made huge gains since the days when we were at 2%. That was the 1970s. So we are steadily growing. And of course, without a proper command of the language, you don't actually have that in-depth understanding of your own culture.
Ko te kai taunaki te reo Māori ko Alana Thomas tērā, e whakapau kahana ki a pui oi o te reo I tōna kāinga.
Māori TV is publicly funded. Its presenters and journalists speak only in Māori. It's a far cry from when children were beaten or whipped at school for speaking their native tongue. Tina Garter is an Indigenous rights campaigner. She believes colonisation has had terrible consequences for language.
We talk about this idea of cultural genocide, and that one of the forms that colonisation takes is that the policies, the legislation, the funding, the structures really lean itself towards only letting you survive if you survive as a colonial version of yourself, and it's much more difficult to survive as a Māori. Our resistance to that is to continue to flood our communities with beautiful Māori speaking, Māori singing, ceremonial and contemporary versions and ongoing evolving versions of ourselves.
Millions of dollars of government money has been promised to help revitalise Māori. Like many other New Zealanders, the Prime Minister Jacinta Ardern is eager to learn.
In New Zealand, there is a Māori proverb, He aha te mea nui o te ao. What is the most important thing in the world? He tangata, he tangata, he tangata. It is the people, the people, the people.
Words such as kia ora, hello, and kai food have long been part of New Zealand English. It's hoped that by 2040, 1 million Kiwis will be able to speak basic Māori. Indigenous New Zealanders make up about 15% of the national population. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Gisborne, New Zealand.
It's time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here's Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Douglas. We begin the sports in New York, where Kenyan dominance in the long-distance races was clearly evident in the New York City Marathon on Sunday. Newcomer and world half-marathon record holder Jocelyn Kipsoge won the women's event of the 2019 New York City Marathon in a time of 2 hours, 22 minutes, 38 seconds. Her time was the second fastest performance at the course for women and the fastest debut at the New York City Marathon. In the men's event, Geoffrey Kamawuro, also from Kenya, took the race in 2 hours, 8 minutes, 13 seconds, winning in New York for the second time in 3 years. Kamawuro is the 10th man to win multiple New York City Marathon titles. In addition to winning the New York City Marathon in 2017, he placed second in 2015 and third last year. Mary Kitiani and Albert Kurie, also of Kenya, were the runners-up. In rugby news, South Africa national rugby side, the Springbok, broke English hearts on Saturday with a ruthless display of power rugby to seize their third Rugby World Cup in devastating fashion. The Springboks won a record-equaling third World Cup title after beating England 32-12 in a dominant performance in Yokohama to match those of 1995 in Johannesburg and 2007 in Paris. South Africa captain Siya Kolisi, who became the first black South African captain to win the Williams Webb Ellis Trophy, says victory will pull the country together. The 28-year-old flanker wears the iconic number 6 jersey for the Springboks, which was the same number worn by Nelson Mandela when he handed the same trophy in 1995 to South Africa captain Francois Pina, who also wore number 6. And in football news, Algerian debutant Parado reached the total CAF Confederations Cup group stage, defeating Ugandan giant Kampala City Council Authority 4-1 in Algiers on Sunday night to qualify for the group stage of the second elite club competition on the continent. In Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire's San Pedro produced one of the memorable CAF Confederations Cup comebacks, defeating Ghanaian giant Ashanti Kotoko 2-0 in Abidjan on Sunday evening to reach the 2019-2020 total CAF Confederations Cup group stage. San Pedro overturned their away first leg 1-0 defeat last weekend to progress 2-1 on aggregate. In other results, DR Congo Giants DC Motema Pembe beat Kenyan champions Gumahia 2-1 in Kinshasa to progress 3-2 on aggregate, having played to a 1-1 draw in the first leg in Nairobi last weekend. While in Nigeria's coal city of Enugu, Rangers International progressed to the group stages after beating Togo's ASC Kara 1-0. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Douglas, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, November 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington, wishing you a very fruitful week.
Hi, I'm Larry London. Don't miss your chance to get the Now 71 CD, including some of the top hit songs of today's biggest stars.
I can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without you.
The CD features Billie Eilish as Bad Guy.
So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad.
Lil Nas X, Old Town Road.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride.
And many of the greatest hits. You can only get the chance to win by listening to Border Crossings, tune us in every day at 1500 UTC.